It was in my mind all the while that I should have to go back to the front as soon as this business was over. It was infuriating. I had been 115 days in the line, and had come back to Barcelona, ravenous for a bit of rest and comfort, and instead I had to spend my time sitting on a roof opposite civil guards as bored as myself, who periodically waved to me and assured me that they were workers, meaning that they hoped I would not shoot them, but who would certainly open fire if they got the order to do so. If this was history, it didn't feel like it. It was more like a bad period at the front, when men were short and we had to do abnormal hours of guard duty. Instead of being heroic, one just had to stay at one's post, bored, dropping with sleep, and completely uninterested as to what it was all about. In the hotel, among the heterogeneous mob, who for the most part had not dared to put their noses out of doors, a horrible atmosphere of suspicion had grown up. Various people were infected with spy mania, and were creeping round whispering that everyone else was a spy of the communists, or the Trotskyists, or the anarchists, or what not. The fat Russian agent was cornering all the foreign refugees in turn, and explaining plausibly that this whole affair was an anarchist plot. I watched him with some interest, for it was the first time that I had seen a person whose profession was telling lies, unless one counts journalists. There was something repulsive in the parody of smart hotel life that was still going on behind shuttered windows, amid the rattle of rifle fire. The front dining room had been abandoned after a bullet came through the window and chipped a pillar, and the guests were crowded into a darkish room at the back, where there were never quite enough tables to go round. The waiters were reduced in numbers, some of them were CNT members and had joined in the general strike, and had dropped their boiled shirts for the time being, but meals were still being served with a pretense of ceremony. There was, however, practically nothing to eat. On that Thursday night, the principal dish at dinner was one sardine each. The hotel had had no bread for days, and even the wine was running so low that we were drinking older and older wines at higher and higher prices. This shortage of food went on for several days after the fighting was over. 3 days running, I remember, my wife and I breakfasted off a little piece of goat's milk cheese with no bread and nothing to drink. The only thing that was plentiful was oranges. The French lorry drivers brought quantities of their oranges into the hotel. They were a tough-looking bunch. They had with them some flashy Spanish girls and a huge porter in a black blouse. At any other time, the little snob of an hotel manager would have done his best to make them uncomfortable. In fact, would have refused to have them on the premises. And they were popular, because, unlike the rest of us, they had a private store of bread, which everyone was trying to cadge from them. I spent that final night on the roof, and the next day it did really look as though the fighting was coming to an end. I don't think there was much firing that day, the Friday. No one seemed to know for certain whether the troops from Valencia were really coming. They arrived that evening, as a matter of fact. The government was broadcasting half-soothing, half-threatening messages, asking everyone to go home and saying that after a certain hour anyone found carrying arms would be arrested. Not much attention was paid to the government's broadcasts, but everywhere the people were fading away from the barricades. I have no doubt that it was mainly the food shortage that was responsible. From every side you heard the same remark, "We have no more food, we must go back to work." On the other hand, the civil guards, who could count on getting their rations so long as there was any food in the town, were able to stay at their posts. By the afternoon, the streets were almost normal, though the deserted barricades were still standing. The Ramblas was thronged with people, the shops nearly all open, and, most reassuring of all, the trams that had stood so long in frozen blocks jerked into motion and began running. The civil guards were still holding the Café Mocha and had not taken down their barricades, but some of them brought chairs out and sat on the pavement with their rifles across their knees. I winked at one of them as I went past and got a not unfriendly grin. He recognised me, of course. Over the telephone exchange, the anarchist flag had been hauled down. That meant that the workers were definitely beaten. I realised, though owing to my political ignorance not so clearly as I ought to have done, that when the government felt more sure of itself, there would be reprisals. But at the time, I was not interested in that aspect of things. All I felt was a profound relief that the devilish din of firing was over, and that one could buy some food and have a bit of rest and peace before going back to the front. It must have been late that evening that the troops from Valencia first appeared in the streets. They were the assault guards, another formation similar to the civil guards and the carabineros, i.e. a formation intended primarily for police work, and the pit troops of the Republic. Quite suddenly they seemed to spring up out of the ground. You saw them everywhere, patrolling the streets in groups of 10. Tall men in grey or blue uniforms, with long rifles slung over their shoulders, and a submachine gun to each group. Meanwhile, there was a delicate job to be done. The 6 rifles, which we had used for the guard in the observatory towers, were still lying there. And by hook or by crook, we had to get them back to the Poom building. It was only a question of getting them across the street. They were part of the regular armory of the building, but to bring them into the street was to contravene the government's order. And if we were caught with them in our hands, we should certainly be arrested. Worse, the rifles would be confiscated. With only 21 rifles in the building, we could not afford to lose 6 of them. After a lot of discussion as to the best method, a red-haired Spanish boy and myself began to smuggle them out. It was easy enough to dodge the assault guard patrols. The danger was the civil guards in the Mocha, who were well aware that we had rifles in the observatory and might give the show away if they saw us carrying them across. Each of us, partially undressed and slung a rifle over the left shoulder, the butt under the armpit, the barrel down the trouser leg. It was unfortunate that they were long Mausers. Even a man as tall as I am cannot wear a long Mauser down his trouser leg without discomfort. It was an intolerable job getting down the corkscrew stair of the observatory with a completely rigid left leg. Once in the street, we found that the only way to move was with extreme slowness, so slowly that you did not have to bend your knees. Outside the picture house, I saw a group of people staring with great interest as I crept along at tortoise speed. I've often wondered what they thought was the matter with me, wounded in the war, perhaps. However, all the rifles were smuggled across without incident. Next day, the assault guards were everywhere, walking the streets like conquerors. There was no doubt that the government was simply making a display of force in order to overawe a population which it already knew would not resist. If there had been any real fear of further outbreaks, the assault guards would have been kept in barracks and not scattered through the streets in small bands. They were splendid troops, much the best I had seen in Spain, and though I suppose they were in a sense the enemy, I couldn't help liking the look of them. But it was with a sort of amazement that I watched them strolling to and fro. I was used to the ragged, scarcely armed militia on the Aragon front, and I hadn't known that the Republic possessed troops like these. It was not only that they were picked men physically, it was their weapons that most astonished me. All of them were armed with brand new rifles of the type known as the Russian rifle. These rifles were sent to Spain by the USSR, but were, I believe, manufactured in America. I examined one of them. It was a far from perfect rifle, but vastly better than the dreadful old blunderbusses we had at the front. The assault guards had 1 submachine gun between 10 men and an automatic pistol each. We at the front had approximately 1 machine gun between 50 men, and as for pistols and revolvers, you could only procure them illegally. The civil guards and carabineros, who were not intended for the front at all, were better armed and far better clad than ourselves. I suspect it's the same in all wars. Always the same contrast between the sleek police in the rear and the ragged soldiers in the line. On the whole, the assault guards got on very well with the population after the first day or two. On the first day, there was a certain amount of trouble because some of the assault guards, acting on instructions, I suppose, began behaving in a provocative manner. Bands of them boarded trams, searched the passengers, and if they had CNT membership cards in their pockets, tore them up and stamped on them. This led to scuffles with armed anarchists, and 1 or 2 people were killed. Very soon, however, the assault guards dropped their conquering air and relations became more friendly. It was noticeable that most of them had picked up a girl after a day or two. The Barcelona fighting had given the Valencia government the long-wanted excuse to assume fuller control of Catalonia. The workers' militias were to be broken up and redistributed among the popular army. The Spanish Republican flag was flying all over Barcelona. The first time I'd seen it, I think, except over a fascist trench. In the working-class quarters, the barricades were being pulled down, rather fragmentarily, for it's a lot easier to build a barricade than to put the stones back. The civil guards were still occupying strategic points. Huge seizures of arms were being made from CNT strongholds, though I have no doubt a good many escaped seizure. La Batalla was still appearing, but it was censored until the front page was almost completely blank. The PSUC papers were uncensored and were publishing inflammatory articles demanding the suppression of the PUM. The PUM was declared to be a disguised fascist organization. Evidently, the official version of the Barcelona fighting was already fixed upon. It was to be represented as a fifth-column fascist rising engineered solely by the PUM. In the hotel, the horrible atmosphere of suspicion and hostility had grown worse now that the fighting was over. In the face of the accusations that were being flung about, it was impossible to remain neutral. The posts were working again, the foreign communist papers were beginning to arrive, and their accounts of the fighting were not only violently partisan, but, of course, wildly inaccurate as to facts. I think some of the communists on the spot, who had seen what was actually happening, were dismayed by the interpretation that was being put upon events, but naturally they had to stick to their own side. Our communist friend approached me once again and asked me whether I would not transfer into the international column. I was rather surprised. "Your papers are saying I'm a fascist," I said. "Surely I should be politically suspect coming from the PUM." "Oh, that doesn't matter. After all, you were only acting under orders." I had to tell him that after this affair I could not join any communist-controlled unit. Sooner or later it might mean being used against the Spanish working class. One could not tell when this kind of thing would break out again, and if I had to use my rifle at all in such an affair, I would use it on the side of the working class and not against them. He was very decent about it, but from now on the whole atmosphere was changed. You could not, as before, agree to differ and have drinks with a man who was supposedly your political opponent. There were some ugly wrangles in the hotel lounge. Meanwhile, the jails were already full and overflowing. After the fighting was over, the anarchists had, of course, released their prisoners, but the civil guards had not released theirs, and most of them were thrown into prison and kept there without trial, in many cases for months on end. As usual, completely innocent people were being arrested owing to police bungling. I mentioned earlier that Douglas Thompson was wounded about the beginning of April. Afterwards, we'd lost touch with him, as usually happened when a man was wounded, for wounded men were frequently moved from one hospital to another. Actually, he was at Tarragona Hospital and was sent back to Barcelona about the time when the fighting started. On the Tuesday morning, I met him in the street. He asked the question everyone was asking, "What the devil is this all about?" I explained as well as I could. Thompson said promptly, "I'm going to keep out of this. My arm's still bad. I shall go back to my hotel and stay there." He went back to his hotel. But unfortunately, how important it is in street fighting to understand the local geography, it was an hotel in a part of the town controlled by the civil guards. The place was raided, and Thompson was arrested, flung into jail, and kept for 8 days in a cell so full of people that nobody had room to lie down. There were many similar cases. Numerous foreigners with doubtful political records were on the run with the police on their track, and in constant fear of denunciation. It was worst for the Italians and Germans, who had no passports, and were generally wanted by the secret police in their own countries. If they were arrested, they were liable to be deported to France, which might mean being sent back to Italy or Germany, where God knew what horrors were awaiting them. One or two foreign women hurriedly regularized their position by marrying Spaniards. A German girl, who had no papers at all, dodged the police by posing for several days as a man's mistress. I remember the look of shame and misery on the poor girl's face when I accidentally bumped into her coming out of the man's bedroom. Of course she was not his mistress, but no doubt she thought I thought she was. You had all the while the hateful feeling that someone hitherto your friend might be denouncing you to the secret police. The long nightmare of the fighting, the lack of food and sleep, the mingled strain and boredom of sitting on the roof and wondering whether in another minute I should be shot myself or be obliged to shoot somebody else had put my nerves on edge. I had got to the point when every time a door banged, I grabbed for my pistol. On the Saturday morning, there was an uproar of shots outside, and everyone cried out, "It's starting again!" I ran into the street to find that it was only some assault guards shooting a mad dog. No one who was in Barcelona then, or for months later, will forget the horrible atmosphere produced by fear, suspicion, hatred, censored newspapers, crammed jails, enormous food queues, and prowling gangs of armed men. I've tried to give some idea of what it felt like to be in the middle of the Barcelona fighting. One of the things that stick in my mind when I look back is the casual contacts one made at the time, the sudden glimpses of non-combatants to whom the whole thing was simply a meaningless uproar. I remember the fashionably dressed woman I saw strolling down the Ramblas with a shopping basket over her arm and leading a white poodle while the rifles cracked and roared a street or two away. It is conceivable that she was deaf. And the man I saw rushing across the completely empty Plaza de Catalunya, brandishing a white handkerchief in each hand, and the large party of people all dressed in black, who kept trying for about an hour to cross the Plaza de Catalunya, and always failing. Every time they emerged from the side street at the corner, the PSUC machine gunners and the Hotel Colón opened fire and drove them back. I don't know why, for they were obviously unarmed. I've since thought that they may have been a funeral party. And the little man who acted as caretaker at the museum over the Poliorama, and who seemed to regard the whole affair as a social occasion. He was so pleased to have the English visiting him. The English were so simpatico, he said. He hoped we would all come and see him again when the trouble was over. As a matter of fact, I did go and see him. And the other little man, sheltering in a doorway, who jerked his head in a pleased manner towards the hell of firing on the Plaza de Catalunya, and said, as though remarking that it was a fine morning, "So, we've got the 19th of July back again." And the people in the shoe shop who were making my marching boots. I went there before the fighting, after it was over, and for a very few minutes during the brief armistice on the 5th of May. It was an expensive shop, and the shop people were UGT, and may have been PSUC members. At any rate, they were politically on the other side, and they knew that I was serving with the POOM, yet their attitude was completely indifferent. Such a pity, this kind of thing, isn't it? And so bad for business. What a pity it doesn't stop. As though there wasn't enough of that kind of thing at the front, etc., etc. There must have been quantities of people, perhaps the majority of the inhabitants of Barcelona, who regarded the whole affair without a flicker of interest, or with no more interest than they would have felt in an air raid. In this chapter I've described only my personal experiences. In the next chapter I must discuss as best I can the larger issues, what actually happened and with what results, what were the rights and wrongs of the affair, and who, if anyone, was responsible. So much political capital has been made out of the Barcelona fighting that it's important to try and get a balanced view of it. An immense amount, enough to fill many books, has already been written on the subject, and I do not suppose I should exaggerate if I said that 9/10 of it is untruthful. Nearly all the newspaper accounts published at the time were manufactured by journalists at a distance, and were not only inaccurate in their facts, but intentionally misleading. As usual, only one side of the question has been allowed to get to the wider public. Like everyone who was in Barcelona at the time, I saw only what was happening in my immediate neighbourhood. But I saw and heard quite enough to be able to contradict many of the lies that have been circulated. As before, if you're not interested in political controversy and the mob of parties and sub-parties with their confusing names, rather like the names of the generals in a Chinese war, please skip. It's a horrible thing to have to enter into the details of inter-party polemics. It's like diving into a cesspool. But it is necessary to try and establish the truth so far as possible. This squalid brawl in a distant city is more important than might appear at first sight. Chapter 11. It will never be possible to get a completely accurate and unbiased account of the Barcelona fighting, because the necessary records do not exist. Future historians will have nothing to go upon except a mass of accusations and party propaganda. I myself have little data beyond what I saw with my own eyes, and what I've learned from other eyewitnesses whom I believe to be reliable. I can, however, contradict some of the more flagrant lies and help to get the affair into some kind of perspective. First of all, what actually happened? For some time past, there had been tension throughout Catalonia. In earlier chapters of this book, I have given some account of the struggle between communists and anarchists. By May 1937, things had reached a point at which some kind of violent outbreak could be regarded as inevitable. The immediate cause of friction was the government's order to surrender all private weapons, coinciding with the decision to build up a heavily armed, non-political police force from which trade union members were to be excluded. The meaning of this was obvious to everyone, and it was also obvious that the next move would be the taking over of some of the key industries controlled by the CNT. In addition, there was a certain amount of resentment among the working classes because of the growing contrast of wealth and poverty, and a general vague feeling that the revolution had been sabotaged. Many people were agreeably surprised when there was no rioting on the 1st of May. On the 3rd of May, the government decided to take over the telephone exchange, which had been operated since the beginning of the war mainly by CNT workers. It was alleged that it was badly run and that official calls were being tapped. Salas, the chief of police, who may or may not have been exceeding his orders, sent 3 lorry loads of armed civil guards to seize the building, while the streets outside were cleared by armed police in civilian clothes. At about the same time, bands of civil guards seized various other buildings in strategic spots. Whatever the real intention may have been, there was a widespread belief that this was the signal for a general attack on the CNT by the civil guards and the PSUC, communists and socialists. The word flew round the town that the workers' buildings were being attacked, armed anarchists appeared on the streets, work ceased, and fighting broke out immediately. That night and the next morning, barricades were built all over the town, and there was no break in the fighting until the morning of the 6th of May. The fighting was, however, mainly defensive on both sides. Buildings were besieged, but, so far as I know, none were stormed, and there was no use of artillery. Roughly speaking, the CNT, FAI, POUM forces held the working-class suburbs, and the armed police forces and the PSUC held the central and official portion of the town. On the 6th of May, there was an armistice. But fighting soon broke out again, probably because of premature attempts by civil guards to disarm CNT workers. Next morning, however, the people began to leave the barricades of their own accord. Up till roughly the night of the 5th of May, the CNT had had the better of it, and large numbers of civil guards had surrendered. But there was no generally accepted leadership and no fixed plan. Indeed, so far as one could judge, no plan at all, except a vague determination to resist the civil guards. The official leaders of the CNT had joined with those of the UGT in imploring everyone to go back to work. Above all, food was running short. In such circumstances, nobody was sure enough of the issue to go on fighting. By the afternoon of the 7th of May, conditions were almost normal. That evening, 6,000 assault guards, sent by sea from Valencia, arrived and took control of the town. The government issued an order for the surrender of all arms except those held by the regular forces, and during the next few days, large numbers of arms were seized. The casualties during the fighting were officially given out as 400 killed and about 1,000 wounded. 400 killed is possibly an exaggeration, But as there is no way of verifying this, we must accept it as accurate. Secondly, as to the after-effects of the fighting. Obviously, it's impossible to say with any certainty what these were. There is no evidence that the outbreak had any direct effect upon the course of the war, though obviously it must have had, if it had continued even a few days longer. It was made the excuse for bringing Catalonia under the direct control of Valencia, for hastening the breakup of the militias, and for the suppression of the PUM, and no doubt it also had its share in bringing down the Caballero government. But we may take it as certain that these things would have happened in any case. The real question is whether the CNT workers who came into the street gained or lost by showing fight on this occasion. It's pure guesswork. But my own opinion is that they gained more than they lost. The seizure of the Barcelona telephone exchange was simply one incident in a long process. Since the previous year, direct power had been gradually manoeuvred out of the hands of the syndicates, and the general movement was away from working-class control and towards centralized control, leading on to state capitalism, or possibly towards the reintroduction of private capitalism. The fact that at this point there was resistance probably slowed the process down. A year after the outbreak of war, the Catalan workers had lost much of their power, but their position was still comparatively favourable. It might have been less so if they had made it clear that they would lie down under no matter what provocation. There are occasions when it pays better to fight and be beaten than not to fight at all. Thirdly, what purpose, if any, lay behind the outbreak? Was it any kind of coup d'etat or revolutionary attempt? Did it definitely aim at overthrowing the government? Was it preconcerted at all? My own opinion is that the fighting was only preconcerted in the sense that everyone expected it. There were no signs of any very definite plan on either side. On the anarchist side, the action was almost certainly spontaneous, for it was an affair mainly of the rank and file. The people came into the streets, and their political leaders followed reluctantly or did not follow at all. The only people who even talked in a revolutionary strain were the Friends of the Ruti, a small extremist group within the FAI and the PUM. But once again, they were following and not leading. The Friends of the Ruti distributed some kind of revolutionary leaflet, but this did not appear until the 5th of May and cannot be said to have started the fighting, which had started of its own accord 2 days earlier. The official leaders of the CNT disowned the whole affair from the start. There were a number of reasons for this. To begin with, the fact that the CNT was still represented in the government and the Generalité ensured that its leaders would be more conservative than their followers. Secondly, the main object of the CNT leaders was to form an alliance with the UGT, and the fighting was bound to widen the split between CNT and UGT, at any rate for the time being. Thirdly, though this was not generally known at the time, the anarchist leaders feared that if things went beyond a certain point, and the workers took possession of the town, as they were perhaps in a position to do on the 5th of May, there would be foreign intervention. A British cruiser and two British destroyers had closed in upon the harbour, and no doubt there were other warships not far away. The English newspapers gave it out that these ships were proceeding to Barcelona to protect British interests, but in fact they made no move to do so. That is, they did not land any men or take off any refugees. There can be no certainty about this, but it was at least inherently likely that the British government, which had not raised a finger to save the Spanish government from Franco, would intervene quickly enough to save it from its own working class. The PUM leaders did not disown the affair. In fact, they encouraged their followers to remain at the barricades and even gave their approval in La Batalla on the 6th of May to the extremist leaflet issued by the Friends of Durruti. There is great uncertainty about this leaflet, of which no one now seems able to produce a copy. In some of the foreign papers, it was described as an inflammatory poster which was plastered all over the town. There was certainly no such poster. From comparison of various reports, I should say that the leaflet called for, one, the formation of a revolutionary council or junta, two, the shooting of those responsible for the attack on the telephone exchange, three, the disarming of the civil guards. There is also some uncertainty as to how far La Bataille expressed agreement with the leaflet. I myself did not see the leaflet or La Bataille of that date. The only handbill I saw during the fighting was one issued by the tiny group of Trotskyists, Bolshevik-Leninists, on the 4th of May. This merely said, "Everyone to the barricades, general strike of all industries except war industries." In other words, it merely demanded what was happening already. But in reality, the attitude of the PUM leaders was hesitating. They'd never been in favour of insurrection until the war against Franco was won. On the other hand, the workers had come into the streets, and the PUM leaders took the rather pedantic Marxist line that when the workers are on the streets, it is the duty of the revolutionary parties to be with them. Hence, in spite of uttering revolutionary slogans about the reawakening of the spirit of the 19th of July and so forth, they did their best to limit the workers' actions to the defensive. They never, for instance, ordered an attack on any building. They merely ordered their followers to remain on guard, and, as I mentioned in the last chapter, not to fire when it could be avoided. La Bataille also issued instructions that no troops were to leave the front, although a recent number of Implecor states the exact opposite, that La Bataille ordered the PUM troops to leave the front. The point can easily be settled by referring to La Bataille of the date named. As far as one can estimate it, I should say that the responsibility of the PUM amounts to having urged everyone to remain at the barricades, and probably to having persuaded a certain number to remain there longer than they would otherwise have done. Those in personal touch with the PUM leaders at the time, I myself was not, have told me that they were in reality dismayed by the whole business, but felt that they had got to associate themselves with it. Afterwards, of course, political capital was made out of it in the usual manner. Gorkin, one of the PUM leaders, even spoke later of the glorious days of May. From the propaganda point of view, this may have been the right line. Certainly the PUM rose somewhat in numbers during the brief period before its suppression. Tactically, it was probably a mistake to give countenance to the leaflet of the Friends of Durruti, which was a very small organization and normally hostile to the PUM. Considering the general excitement and the things that were being said on both sides, the leaflet did not in effect mean much more than stay at the barricades. But by seeming to approve of it, while Solidaridad Obrera, the anarchist paper, repudiated it, the PUM leaders made it easy for the communist press to say afterwards that the fighting was a kind of insurrection engineered solely by the PUM. However, we may be certain that the communist press would have said this in any case. It was nothing compared with the accusations that were made both before and afterwards on less evidence. The CNT leaders did not gain much by their more cautious attitude. They were praised for their loyalty, but were levered out of both the government and the Generalité as soon as the opportunity arose. So far as one could judge from what people were saying at the time, there was no real revolutionary intention anywhere. The people behind the barricades were ordinary CNT workers, probably with a sprinkling of UGT workers among them, and what they were attempting was not to overthrow the government, but to resist what they regarded, rightly or wrongly, as an attack by the police. Their action was essentially defensive, and I doubt whether it should be described, as it was in nearly all the foreign newspapers, as a rising. A rising implies aggressive action and a definite plan. More exactly, it was a riot. A very bloody riot, because both sides had firearms in their hands and were willing to use them. But what about the intentions on the other side? If it was not an anarchist coup d'etat, was it perhaps a communist coup d'etat? A planned effort to smash the power of the CNT at one blow? I don't believe it was, though certain things might lead one to suspect it. It is significant that something very similar, seizure of the telephone exchange by armed police acting under orders from Barcelona, happened in Tarragona 2 days later. And in Barcelona, the raid on the telephone exchange was not an isolated act. In various parts of the town, bands of civil guards and PSUC adherents seized buildings in strategic spots, if not actually before the fighting started, at any rate with surprising promptitude. But what one has got to remember is that these things were happening in Spain, and not in England. Barcelona is a town with a long history of street fighting. In such places, things happen quickly, the factions are ready made, everyone knows the local geography, and when the guns begin to shoot, people take their places almost as if in a fire drill. Presumably those responsible for the seizure of the telephone exchange expected trouble, though not on the scale that actually happened, and had made ready to meet it. But it does not follow that they were planning a general attack on the CNT. There are two reasons why I don't believe that either side had made preparations for large-scale fighting. One, neither side had brought troops to Barcelona beforehand. The fighting was only between those who were in Barcelona already, mainly civilians and police. Two, the food ran short almost immediately. Anyone who served in Spain knows that the one operation of war that Spaniards perform really well is that of feeding their troops. It is most unlikely that if either side had contemplated a week or two of street fighting and a general strike, they would not have stored food beforehand. Finally, as to the rights and wrongs of the affair. A tremendous dust was kicked up in the foreign anti-fascist press. But, as usual, only one side of the case has had anything like a hearing. As a result, the Barcelona fighting has been represented as an insurrection by disloyal anarchists and Trotskyists who were stabbing the Spanish government in the back, and so forth. The issue was not quite so simple as that. Undoubtedly, when you're at war with a deadly enemy, it is better not to begin fighting among yourselves. But it is worth remembering that it takes two to make a quarrel, and that people do not begin building barricades unless they have received something that they regard as a provocation.